And now that we've come to the end of this long campaign, we want to take a minute now to look back at some of the best reporting that came out of it with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I feel like David Farenthold of The Washington Post, who's been reporting on Trump's charitable contributions or lack thereof, would have to make anyone's list.
I think it's at the top. I think it was spectacular on two levels. It was really bird-dogging one way of holding Trump accountable for his public statements and his past record of statements, the image that he created of himself as this sort of gruff, brash-talking philanthropist billionaire with a heart of gold who quietly did a lot of good. And he really tried to track down with any number of charities, particularly initially for veterans groups, any evidence showing that Trump had done what he had said he had done, and found scant evidence. The other thing that was tremendous about what Farenthold did was he did it in public. He kept posting these lists of veterans groups that he had reached out to. He encouraged other people to make suggestions when the Trump campaign folks and the Trump organization folks weren't really being responsive to him. He posted publicly to allow just ordinary citizens who might know of something to respond, to allow people from those organizations to respond and know what his questions were, and also to show his homework in public. I thought it was a tremendous display of accountability journalism.
What else stands out to you in the reporting on this campaign?
You know, there were some things along the way that I think were signposts that were meaningful and that people may not have recognized at the time. If you think over a year ago, Evan Osnos of The New Yorker wrote a piece where he ended up kind of by accident doing a piece about the way in which Trump's rhetoric had tapped into what some call the alt-right, but really was a form of white nationalist and racist rhetoric and sympathies. And by going to certain kinds of gatherings and groups meetings, he realized that Trump had tapped into this kind of seemingly submerged belief system and rhetoric that was going to form part of Trump's appeal to certain voters. And that really proved over the course of the campaign, but it was written back in, you know, late summer of 2015. I thought that was remarkable work. Similarly, there are folks, some of the chroniclers of Trump over the years emerged, Wayne Barrett, David K. Johnson, and certainly others, to really try to provide some context for all of those business dealings Trump had, about the way in which he really was a brand at times more than a business in and of itself. You know, you've got to also think of the piece that Jane Mayer did in The New Yorker talking to Trump's ghostwriter, which I originally thought was sort of a cute and frivolous way of looking at Trump. And the more you read it, the more it was sort of like a horror story talking about him. I felt that the reporting on Hillary Clinton was less imaginative, more kind of by the books. But then again, Clinton herself is a known quantity. She's been pored over by the press and, for that matter, by certain Republican-led congressional investigative committees for basically the last 2.5 decades. And I thought that stood out less. One other thing I'd say is that a lot of the embeds, particularly the younger reporters who've been tracking the campaign for the trail, really used social media wonderfully to capture the essence of what it was like to be there, at times to throw a little shade and provide more voice, which is a little controversial among some of our perhaps more veteran colleagues, but nonetheless giving you a texture of what it was like to not only cover the campaign, to be with the campaigns, but also at times to deal with the campaigns. And I thought that was important, too.
I just want to point out one thing, David, which is a lot of the reporting that you have talked about as being very good reporting has been in print publications at a time when we are still seeing kind of a decline in print journalism, layoffs happening still, they're losing revenue. What does that say to you, that they're still doing such important reporting even though they're dealing with fewer resources?
Sure. This is one of the fundamental truths that has not changed, even as we've seen so much sweeping changes in the media landscape, which is that it is the traditional legacy newspapers, even as they become more digitized outfits, that provide the greatest part of the horsepower that propels journalism forward. These are the engines that serve to inspire so much coverage on cable news, on the news wires, all of the kinds of takes from places like Vox and other sites that tend to analyze rather than simply doing original reporting. You know, newspapers are a vital part of how democracy functions and have been for decades and continue to be so, even as, you know, we're not talking about modest declines here. We're talking about really perilous drops in advertising seen by really important companies, the parent companies of The New York Times, of The Wall Street Journal, of Gannett, which owns USA Today, which did a fantastic piece analyzing the 3,500 lawsuits that Trump and his businesses have been embroiled in. All of these major major important owners of powerful papers, both national and regional, has suffered sweeping losses in terms of how much revenue they derive from advertising. They are more and more dependent upon subscribers. And in a sense, they're really reverting to kind of a public radio way of saying things. Some of these newspapers call their subscribers members, as though they're public radio donors for local stations, because they're saying you have to personally support the kinds of journalism that emerges from what we do. We can no longer rely on advertisers to do so indirectly, simply to get your eyeballs.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks so much.
You bet.